Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA, to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
All right, Entree Architect community, it's time for context and clarity. The reason that I come to you every day is so that we can find clarity around the things that matter most to you, the architect. And it doesn't matter if you're the employee of a firm, maybe you dream of starting your own firm. Maybe you even said 2021 is my year and you're on the runway to starting your own firm. Maybe you've had a firm for a year or 10 years or 20 years and you're starting to rethink, reimagine what your firm could or should be. All of the topics that we cover, one topic every day, fall under the broad umbrella of the business of architecture, and they are the need-to-know topics for the success of architects just like you. You know, at the end of every episode of Context and Clarity, I ask you to find some time to breathe and relax and find a way to rejuvenate. And that's exactly what we're doing at Context and Clarity right now. It's the holidays, and Catherine and I and the entire Context and Clarity team, well, we're taking a break. But I didn't want you to be without Context and Clarity Live, so I thought I would share with you one of my favorites from the first 45 episodes of Context and Clarity Live. This one is Roxane Gay. Before we jump into the conversation, though, I thought I'd give you a little backstory on this conversation with Roxane. Honestly, Roxane Gay was a surprise. We actually had Debbie Millman, the host of Design Matters, scheduled for that week of Context and Clarity Live. But unfortunately, at the last minute, Debbie came down with something and wasn't feeling well. So her wife, Roxane Gay, volunteered to step in Debbie's place. That is absolutely amazing. First of all, to go from planning to talk to a luminary in the design and podcasting space to a luminary in the human rights and social issues and writing space. Absolutely amazing. So Roxane was a very last minute substitution, I guess you should say. You might, if you heard that we were going to talk to Roxane Gay, you might have expected a different conversation, but nobody was prepared for that. So we just had a very human conversation with Roxane. And one of the, I think, big highlights of that conversation was that we found out that Debbie and Roxane are planning to build or renovate a home in Los Angeles. And so we talked through this whole process of finding a home, finding an architect, interviewing an architect, and working with an architect from the client's point of view. And I think it turned out to be a really great conversation. So I hope you enjoy the surprise conversation with Roxane Gay. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back very soon. Roxane, like I said, and as you know, we've been talking about courage, different mm-hmm. things that require courage. And so, you know, I think about it, again, our audience is probably today going to be mostly architects. You're not an architect, you're a writer, prolific writer at that. A lot of what we've talked about, fear holding us back, imposter syndrome, perfectionism, I just rattled off a whole list of bestsellers mm-hmm. that you have written, that you have produced in lots of different genres, by the way. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of your work. And so it strikes me that when we're talking about all of these things that we've been talking about all week, it's got to take a lot of courage. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's got to take a lot of courage for you to put pen to paper or maybe look at the blank screen with a blinking cursor or whatever tools you use to do your work. But how much courage does it take to put yourself out there like you do every time that you write something?
Well, thanks for having me. You know, it depends, honestly. A lot of times people think I have far more courage than I actually do.
Okay.
But it does take some courage to write. Not to write. I think, you know, if you're just keeping your writing to yourself, it takes some courage, but not the most courage. But to put your work in front of an audience and subject yourself to their opinions takes a lot of courage. And I tend to be terrified about almost everything I write and how it's going to be received. And I just submit, I put my work out anyway, despite the terror. And if you want to call that courage, sure. But the fear is overwhelming. And, you know, I think it's because I know that there's something at stake. And I think whenever we care, we tend to be afraid. Because we, you know, there's so much that can be on the line, especially as a writer. The writing life for most writers is pretty precarious. And I that's why I always tell young writers, keep your day job. Your day job is your best friend. It's a lot easier to create when you're not worried about paying the rent, buying groceries, putting gas in your car. So, you know, I just try to balance fear and the ability to like work through the fear. And, you know, this is what I've done with that.
Well, it's there's a lot of great points wrapped up into that. And I think, you know, one of the things that I wonder, as you were explaining that, I started to think, you know, that you're talking a lot about the creative process and the risk in the creative process and putting yourself out there. How you said you push through it. So how do you push through it? Do you have tools? Do you have techniques that you used? Or is it just...
Do you just count down and then push through? Because that's what I do sometimes.
What I do is I tell myself that no one's going to read my work. And so it doesn't matter what I've said and how it's received, because there is going to be no reception. And that is incredibly useful. And of course, the deeper I get into my career, the more challenging it is to nurture that disbelief. But I do it anyway. I sure do. And I just tell myself it doesn't matter. Like, girl, say what you want. It's going to be fine.
Are you ever surprised at the, I'm sure you can be surprised at some of the, you know, some of the stuff that comes in, but are you ever surprised? Because you're setting up that disbelief in your mind, are you ever surprised at the number of people that have read or have engaged?
Yes, I am. You know, when you're a writer, you don't expect to find an audience. Something is going to happen with your career, that you're going to find an audience, and that maybe once in a while you'll make a little more. And that audience appreciates what I have to say. It's a small miracle, and it's something that I never take for granted.
I think that's an incredible outlook. It, you know, for a lot of us, you know, whether it is a podcast or you are writing, there's a part of me that thinks that we ought to go into it not worrying whether or not there's an audience. But the reality is, and like you said, don't quit your day job. The reality is, especially if we're maybe for this audience who are professionals, right? Professional services. So if they're an architect or they're a doctor or they're an attorney, whatever they are, there's different versions, of course, of putting yourself out there no matter what you do. But the they're required, I suppose, to at least put on an air of confidence. You know, no patient wants their doctor to walk into the exam room and go, yeah, I really don't know what I'm doing, right? So we've got to project at least an air of confidence. But I was thinking earlier today that I don't think I can imagine a state where doctor, attorney, architect, whatever, we're in the first meeting with their client or their patient, whatever they call them, the person they serve, where they have all the answers right then. So it's this, it's got to be this process of figuring out as you go. So that's got to require courage as well. Like, oh my gosh, I'm dealing with whatever this is. Any advice for somebody that's in a figure it out as you go, but you've got to project confidence from the get-go?
Well, I don't know that you need to project confidence. I think you need to project competence. And those
interesting.
Are
different. Yeah.
You know, I think confidence is attractive in a professional context, in a personal context, but not everyone has all the answers all of the time. But I want to be able to trust any professional that I'm working with, whether it's in the creative field or in the professional field. In fact, we're about to hire an architect to build a house. I want to know that person can do and execute my vision and can do what I need them to do and can admit when they don't know something, but can find answers to those questions. And competence is something that does that. There are all kinds of confident people that are utterly incompetent and who do sloppy work. And right. The confidence is, in fact, a disguise. It's a shield. And, you know, I think we put way too much stock in the importance of confidence without substance.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there. So you've opened up a wormhole now, right?
I think she's already got a short list, everybody. Don't get excited.
No, I don't, actually.
Oh, no, you don't.
Starting from scratch. But wow. We're building in Los Angeles.
Oh,
we are building in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Wow.
Let me ask you this then, because there are a lot of architects listening right now. When someone is looking to hire an architect to design a home, this is great because this is the other side of the table, right? What do you think you want in an architect and how will you make that selection?
I think she wants someone super arrogant and confident, I think.
Right? Yeah, that's exactly what I want.
Right.
That's a really good question. And I think one of the things we need to figure out is what we want in an architect. You know, people have given us some names, and these are incredibly impressive architects who have beautiful portfolios. And it seems like, yes, they would be wonderful to work with. But, you know, we want someone who's going to actually listen to us about what we want. One of us is a designer. So one of us has all kinds of really, really intense opinions about how things should look. And so we also need someone who's kind of flexible and who will be patient with working with a designer. And we also want someone who has creative ideas and who can stand up to us. And, you know, sometimes like, you'll be like, I want a swing set in the living room. And I'm sure there's an architect who will be like, I hear you, but.
And I can see why that would be fun. That's
interesting. I also want someone who will push back when our ideas are just unrealistic or they're in the long term won't look good or won't be useful for us. So, you know, it starts with, do you share our aesthetic? And do you like beautiful things? And can you create beautiful spaces? And then, you know, what are you like to work with? How busy are you? How responsive are you on email? Like those kinds of things matter. And how do you create boundaries and say, that's enough. Don't email me anymore for the day. frankly, that's not going to happen because we're actually too busy. But we just want to know that we're, you know, this is a dream home that we'll be building if we can't find the right house. And so far, we haven't found the right house. And so we're going to be spending a lot of money. And so we would like to know that money is going to be well spent.
That
I'm not even in California, and I just love hearing that. You're going to spend a lot of money. You want a swing set? I mean, that's
You just want to go all out. Well, you know, we have a couple different like sort of constraints. You know, we need two home offices. We need an in-law suite or a second home on the property for my parents. It's just a lot. And so we need someone who can accommodate all of that. And it's in LA, this is like, I don't want to say standard, like everyone has it, but there are a lot of houses that have in-law suites in Los Angeles because there's a housing crisis. And the city has decided one of the ways to solve that high crisis is to allow people to build these things they call ADUs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's like all of that. And so it's a kind of exciting, but it's also overwhelming.
Yep.
So if you're talking to an architect, right, and you've seen their portfolio, like you said, and I'm guessing you're going to go through a set of interviews basically to talk to these people. Do you have any feel? And I know some of it is just going to be, you'll get a feeling about someone, you know, just the same way we get feelings no matter what we're searching for. Do you have any idea how you might balance all of those things that you're talking about and how you might quote unquote score it? Or is it just going to be, I'll know it when I see, or we'll know it when we see it kind of thing?
I think it's one of those we'll know it when we see it kinds of things, but artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. Like, mm-hmm. I don't need you to hold my hand. I don't need you to be my friend. I have friends. You know, I do need you to respect me, but I don't need you to be warm and fuzzy. And so really for me, open communication, a willingness to hear our ideas, but just a beautiful aesthetic is going to be the priority, because when the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
That's kind of interesting, because we were talking about, that is actually interesting, because we have been talking about emotional intelligence with, you know, how important is that as architects? People have varying degrees of it and everything. And so the idea of relating to clients and being able to be emotionally in tune with them and that sort of thing is something that we think about. But so it's kind of interesting to think that you aren't, it's kind of crushing actually to think that you're not interested in being friends with your architect after, because I guess
that's wonderful. Like I would enjoy that very much. Like the realtor who sold me my first house is our realtor now. And we became friends through the process, and I think we'll always be friends. And so it's just, if it doesn't happen, it's okay. If you're like not a perfect sort of friendly person, if we don't jive on a personal level, but we jive on a professional level, it's totally fine.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that's great.
I guess we like to think we need to be more charming, you know, and that's going to get us the job, but I guess.
Yeah, and you know, I teach, or sometimes I used to be a professor. I'm taking a couple of years off. You know, people tend to expect you to be sort of like, they think of it as client services, and it's not, it's education. And so it's frustrating sometimes to have to be expected to be an entertainer and a charmer, but also to be an expert in my field. It's like, wait, you can have two of those three. You can't have all three.
Yeah.
That's a lot of balls to have in the air.
It is.
I know Catherine is working on
it's too long to fit in there. Can I read it and then I'll summarize it later? Okay. So we had a question from Rod who said, I would like her to talk about the two creator households and the challenges associated with having the space, privacy, energy, support needed and given, required to do good work and give good partner. What that last
that's
part.
A great question, Rod. You know, we're figuring that out right now. What we're doing is she's based in New York and I'm based in Los Angeles, and we go back and forth every few months. And it's interesting because we each have very specific spaces, and we also have home offices. We both have home offices in both spaces. But in one city, you know, it's her aesthetic that dominates, and in the other, it's mine. And so what we're looking for is a space where both of us can feel like we are, it doesn't have to necessarily be equal, because as my mom says, there's no such thing as 50-50 in a marriage, but where we both feel well represented. And where there are creative spaces, and especially for Debbie, a space where she can do the business side of her work, but also a studio space where she can do the more creative hands-on side of her work. A place where we can have some of our staff show up once in a while and not feel like they're in our private home space. Mm-hmm. A space where you look around and you know that creative people live in this space. And so I'm a writer. And so, you know, I have a ton of books. I have a home library. And so, you know, we want to be able to display books. We want to be able to display, we both have significant art collections. And so we want to be able to display the collections. You know, we just looked at a house in Silver Lake, and it was a beautiful, beautiful home. And it was Barbara Bester, which is great. And there was not really much wall space. And so as walking through it, we were like, yeah, it was the right size. It actually had an office section. It had like it had an in-law suite. It had literally everything we were looking for, but there was nowhere to put the art. And so things like that matter to us. And this kind of stuff fuels our creativity, both personally and professionally. So that's kind of what we're looking for. And also really lovely common spaces, because we do spend a lot of social time together now, especially with COVID. Things changed. And I saw someone asked, you know,
yeah, I was going to put that up there.
Needs for space changed. Well, one, ample space to work. We actually converted a bedroom, a master bedroom. I have two master bedrooms in LA, and it's not as fancy as it sounds. And so we turned one of them into Debbie's home office, because it has big windows, it has high ceilings, and so she can really create in there and also teach and do her other things. And so we're thinking more now about like, how can we genuinely be comfortable at home, and both in terms of our work, but in terms of having friends over and cooking for dinner, and knowing like we may not be able to leave the house for 3 months. So like, what kind of space do you want to be in when you cannot go outside? That's helping shape what we want.
Speaking of cooking, which I know is that, do you call it cooking or baking? What is your passion? Don't you?
I do both.
Okay. I saw a tweet of yours. This is way off on a tangent. I'm just apologizing ahead of time. So we got off on a tangent yesterday of cookies, and you had a tweet in the last day or so, I forget when it was, about French toast cookies.
I did.
Oh, what's and that? Does it involve raisins? Because we hope not. That was a big controversy.
No at all. No. So Christina Tosi is the owner of Milk Bar. She's an incredible baker based here in New York. And Debbie had done some consulting for her from Milk Bar at one point, and she had appeared on Debbie's podcast. And I started following her because I was really interested, because I love baking. And at the time, I didn't have any time because I tour constantly pre-COVID. And so I was on the road almost every week. So I would read about bakers and just enjoy like their recipes. And so she has this thing she started during the pandemic called Bake Club, where once a week or so, it used to be every day, but now it's about once a week, she does a video and she bakes something lovely. And most of the stuff is like stuff I'm never going to eat. But a couple of days ago, she did a video about French toast cookies. And I was like, well, that is something I would enjoy. And so I went online and found the recipe, and because I was writing it down from her video, and I was like, I don't have all day for this. And so I used Google. I found the recipe and I made the cookies last night, and it was a lot of fun. It was a really great recipe. She writes really good recipes. And French toast cookies, it's got bits of French toast inside what is essentially a sugar cookie base.
I saw it. I saw your tweet. I saw the picture and I about fell out. So
it's like, I highly recommend if you enjoy baking, it's.
Which one is it? There are lots of them here. I'm going to post it for everybody to make. We can make them and
discuss later. If you Google Christina Tosi French Bake Club, it's on the Bake Club website.
Awesome. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, before I have to run off and grab a cookie or something, we better pull it back. With the new home in LA, is the podcast studio going to be built in it?
Absolutely. We have podcast studio in each house because we both have podcasts.
Yeah.
And we will be making a special, if not in one, if not two. And I know that sounds weird, but we have recording conflicts more than you would think. And so we want a room that's dedicated because right now it's my office that doubles as a podcast studio. And we've sort of put up soundproofing and things like that, but it's not ideal. And we know we could get better sound quality from just a dedicated home studio. And it doesn't have to be big, quite honestly. It's, you know, if we find like a walk-in closet that we don't need, it could be that. But yes, there will absolutely be a dedicated podcast studio wherever we end up.
Wow. It is interesting that your creatives in your work, not to discount the podcasting in any way, because that's huge for both of you, but you've got so many different facets of the creative and each one having their own. It's pretty amazing. It's going to have to be almost a Noah's Ark of things.
Yeah. If we can find a way to do it so that it's one room but divided in half. I mean, we're not going to dedicate two entire rooms in a house to this, I assure you. But my goal is to find a way for us to be able to record at the same time without letting the podcast dominate the house, because studios are not really attractive places.
This is true.
So we have a question here from Chris Novelli. I don't know, it's all going to fit. As a creative person during these unique times, what are some ways to put yourself out there in different ways? I think I don't know what he's thinking, but I'm, you know, just that we have to change what we would normally be doing because we have the travel and all that. Yeah.
You know, I'm really lucky. I have speaking agents, and so they put me out there for me. I panicked when I realized that the world was going to shut down. And I also told myself, oh, it's going to be 3 months. I can live for 3 months without income. Because like many writers, I make more income from touring and public speaking than I do from writing. So, you know, I just thought, okay, I can get through 3 months. And then I thought I can get through a year, which I could. And fortunately, around 3 or 4 months in, people started to figure out ways of doing virtual events. And so that work has returned. And in some ways I am able to go to places that I would not ordinarily want to travel to because I am doing these virtual spaces. But I think that if you are looking for ways to put yourself out there right now as a creative person, you should be willing to propose an idea to whoever would be hosting some sort of event or creative opportunity. I think right now people are looking for innovation, and I think that there is a really rich opportunity here for people to do something more than just like a Zoom reading or conversation or panel. I mean, those are well and good, but I have seen enough at this point. And I would love to see someone really innovate in this space and do something fresh. I watched this play several months ago that was produced in part by Jeremy O'Harris, who did Slave Play. And I'm forgetting the name, but it was unlike anything I had ever seen. And it really worked as a play designed to be executed in a virtual space. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see more creative people doing that sort of thing, thinking outside of the computer screen and the proverbial box. And I think artists can put themselves out in that way by using their imaginations to come up with these interesting ideas and then pitching them to whomever. Sometimes, I think especially over the past year, I think a lot of creative people have realized that we can't sit and wait for the work to come to us, because a lot of people don't ever prioritize creativity, and they're certainly not going to prioritize it during a pandemic. And so we have to show them why they need to make it a priority. And that's the challenge in front of us. And I think most of us are capable of rising to that occasion.
That's a really great comment. And I'm going to selfishly get this in before the next question, but you just said something about most people not prioritizing creativity, which I think is completely true. And I know that many of the architects who are watching this, especially when it comes to designing homes, right? There are a lot of options depending on where you are in the country. You can go to a builder, you can buy one that's already existing, you can renovate it or not. There's lots and lots of options out there. So, and you said that you had looked at some and hadn't found a home. And we're still
looking, but we just, the more we look, the more we realize, at what the price point is reaching, we might as well just either renovate a sort of tear down or start from scratch on a piece of empty land. There's so many options. It's overwhelming.
Let me ask you this. Since there are so many options, why are you going to an architect? Why are you going to use an architect rather than, say, a builder or somebody like that?
It's a trick question.
It's not a trick question.
I think we're going to use both, honestly.
Well, sure. Yeah.
You know, the architect, I think, is because we're both creative people and we have such specific needs. And we have seen a lot of houses from builders, like these brand new renos and gut jobs. LA is good for them. Like, they're a dime a dozen and they're extraordinarily expensive, but they're all so bland. They're like, let's just, you know, take this 8,000 square foot lot and put a 7,800 square foot house on it. True story. And, you know, it looks, it's all white walls and weird, ugly marble. And, you know, it's like a very masculine aesthetic, but not even interesting masculine.
I know. It's a weird, we got to name it. Like, because that's all over the country. It's the same.
Yeah, it's so, it's like, I get it. And like, on the one hand, it's appealing in that you move in and it's a tabula rasa. You can do whatever. But on the other hand, it's like, at this price point, like, I want it to be like one of the things Debbie has said at most of the houses we looked at. She's like, this isn't special. It doesn't feel, there's no grand entrance. There's nothing memorable. There's no quirkiness. And it's all very, it's supposed, they call it like luxury, but it's all just cookie cutter. Yeah. And so I don't know that there's the same level of creativity or refinement with a builder, with all due respect to builders. My dad's an engineer, so I'm all down with builders. But
they try to do what people like. Like, this is what people like, is what they tell me all the time. Like, who are the people? What people? So,
yes, I don't know exactly. Like, who, you know, especially in Los Angeles, I tend to wonder, like, who are you designing this house for? And I know that the answer is like some rich guy who doesn't have any kids who wants to have a bachelor pad. But exactly, it's like, a bachelor pad is this size. Like, what is, really? That's a big bachelor. So, someone said it's the restoration hardware aesthetic. And that's actually very true. I've seen a lot of staged houses with restoration hardware furniture. And I have a restoration hardware couch. And so I'm not judging restoration hardware. But for an entire house, that's a lot of, that's a lot of dark, heavy furniture.
Rod says, not interesting masculine is his life story. So a sad tale.
That is. All right. You had a question up there that I stepped all over, Catherine. I apologize.
Well, that's okay. I just was getting excited about doing my job. But, I mean, I'm glad we continued on to have that part of the So where am I here? So Jay actually says, you taught a masterclass on writing for social change. And what can you tell us in 2 minutes that we can take to our work?
That's a good question. I think the most important thing that I try to impart when it comes to writing at all is that you have to be consistent in your practice. And that's not the sexy part that people, you know, people want to hear about the like soaring creativity and that magic of creation, which is absolutely important. But you have to give yourself as many opportunities as possible to get to that magical moment, to say the amazing thing that's going to create social change. And for me, consistency and practice has been the thing. you know, I am incredibly prolific, not by choice, but I think that's what the market has demanded. I think writers of color have a different level of expectation for what they need to produce to get to the same place that some of our white peers achieve with far less. Mm-hmm. And so consistent practice has made it possible. Like write every day, and you don't have to do it every day. Consistent just means regular. But for me, that has meant writing every day, reading every day, and spending time thinking about what I care about, doing research every day. And I think consistency tends to start to show up in your work, and it gives you an authority that you can then use to bring your readers to whatever place you want them to be at by the time they finish an essay or a story or a book. And so I think a lot of it starts with consistency, no matter what you're doing creatively.
For those of you that are out there in the audience that joined us several weeks ago when we had Seth Godin on as a guest, did any of that sound familiar to you? I mean, to me, that's one of those, when we start hearing multiple people saying very similar things, it becomes, that's got to be truth, right? Because Seth Godin talked about, you know, something very similar. You put in the work. And of course, he says, you know, a lot of the work that he's put out is not great work. But eventually you might hit on something that's good. So I love that idea of sometimes we got to grind, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it's not really glamorized, and it shouldn't be. And also I do think it's important to make a distinction between grind and overwork, because so many industries, especially I'm thinking of video games in particular, but I think it can apply to almost, I was an architecture major back in the day.
You were an architecture major?
I was. When I was at Yale. I majored in architecture.
How did we even miss that? That is huge.
It is, but the problem with my architecture was I had really great ideas in terms of like interesting things for buildings, but A, I'm not great at drawing, but more importantly, I had no sense of structure, and so none of my shit was going to stand up ever.
Well, that's why you have an engineer. You should don't give up on your dreams. You don't have to draw or have any structural.
No, I found something else to do with my creativity. But yeah, wow. You know, well, grinding shouldn't be like grinding yourself into the ground.
Yeah.
Right. But you should probably also tell your future architect that you were an architecture major.
No, I will never admit that ever. Well, because I don't want them to think I'm trying to be like, I took a few biology classes when I'm talking, like, you know, when some people talk to a doctor and they're like, I can do that. I'm like, no, I can't do that. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so it just reminded me of the Done and Shipped. Mark had previously asked a question about, do you have support and do you have tools or tips for getting the work out every day? I guess Done and Shipped.
Yeah. Well, I have a full-time assistant, and that goes a really long way, because she does all of the stuff I don't want to do, and also manages my calendar. She manages a lot of emails and scheduling, travel arrangements, coordinating meetings, coming to meetings to take notes. And when you have someone to handle all of those, in fact, I'm about to hire her an assistant. When you have someone to manage all of that, it makes it so much easier to be creative. So many people struggle with creativity because there's, and myself included, like when you don't have any help, you have to do it all yourself. You're not only the creative engine, but you're also the mechanic that keeps the engine functioning. And so having support staff has been incredibly useful to getting the work done. Deadlines are somewhat useful, but I tend to not make them. So I don't know how good of a tool they are. And just ambition. I mean, ambition work does a lot of the work to keep moving forward, to keep creating not only good work, but good work. And so, yes.
I love that, because a lot of the topics that we cover are, you know, I often open up and say they all fall under the broad umbrella of the business of architecture. And I think that's a great point. And if you're a small firm, if you're a solopreneur, if you're one person, you're wearing a lot of hats, and you have to, But I think that that idea of creating space by hiring an assistant or an assistant to your assistant or whatever that looks like, for, you know, for someone's context, I think creating that space for creativity is a really important idea that I hope everybody takes away from that comment. I think it's really important. I'm 100% guilty of as charged, but that's a great, great idea, great concept there.
And it took a long time for me to get to a place like one, I wanted to make sure I could only do it when I could pay the person a fair wage and mm-hmm. provide health insurance, which I do, and provide retirement, which I do. Mm-hmm. Until I could do that, I was not going to do it because I just, it was not something that my principles would allow. But I also had to teach myself to delegate because I'm a control freak. And I'm just like, I could just do it myself. Like, that's not helping. And so right. it's actually really hard to relinquish some of that control. But I am still an ongoing project, but teaching myself to relinquish control and to trust Caitlin is my assistant. And assistant isn't even, it doesn't feel like an adequate word for what right. she is in my practice. But it's just challenging, but I'm so grateful that I have it now, because I was really drowning and now I'm drowning, but I can sort of, I'm holding onto a life raft.
Yeah. Yeah. That I think a lot of people can identify yeah. with that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was just saying that to my assistant this morning. I said, I could get somebody to do this and that, but I could also do it. She's like, you could do it. Like, yeah, I could. And I can't, I don't know. I can't let you do it. So we're having this little thing. So maybe you're going to inspire me to let it, just trust her.
Yeah, just trust her, you know, and it's hard. There are sometimes like, when she doesn't do it exactly the way I want her to do it. So there are times when I get like, and then I think, wait, no, if I want it done my way, then I need to do it. If she does it her way and gets to whatever result I need, it doesn't matter how she got from point A to point Z. Mm-hmm. You know, what matters is that she got there and she did it well. And right. so, yeah, it's challenging though. I'm glad to hear I'm not the only one who sort of struggles. Well, you're definitely not the
only one, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, So
I think you're surrounded by a community that struggles.
We were just talking about perfectionism the other day, and it kind of ties into that in a way, right? Yeah. It's like, I want it done. Like, I think I'm not a perfectionist, but then it turns out like, oh no, you're supposed to put the carrots against the bread with the mayonnaise. It's not supposed to be between the cheese and the cucumber, because that's not going to work, you know? So it turns out I'm really, really particular about certain things. And, you know, I might be hard to work with.
And it's okay. Not enough women allow themselves to be difficult. Meanwhile, our friends, our male friends, they like revel in being difficult and they're celebrated for it. Like, look at this amazing artist. He's so difficult, but he's brilliant. And a woman is just like difficult and therefore incompetent.
Well, yeah. Hmm. I don't think that's a whole nother podcast. Maybe that's your podcast, I think, right? So. So should I ask this question, Jeff?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead and do that. And I've got one I want to find.
Just to follow up a little bit on your consistency thing. Do you have a specific routine that you follow in order to stay consistent every day?
I do not, simply because just the nature of my life does not allow it. From one day to the next, everything is going to be different. My career is weird. And, you know, like normally as a writer, you write a book, you put it into the world. If you're lucky, people review it, respond to it. You write another book. But I've had opportunities to move into film and television, the public speaking. I've done a little acting, even though I have no interest in it.
What were you on?
I was on the L Word. It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. And also like weird. But you know, because of these opportunities, every day is different. Every day is kind of an adventure. And so I just make the time, and sometimes I have Caitlin build it into my calendar, unstructured time, so that I can either read and or write or think or outline or whatever I need to do. So that's the consistent thing, that I just try to find the time. And not every day is going to be 3 or 4 or 8 or 10 hours of writing. Some days I do 30 minutes, but at least it keeps that muscle limber and it allows me to sort of the next day and the day after still be able to do what I need to do because I haven't, like, the muscle memory isn't gone.
That's awesome. The muscle memory. We've got to develop that.
10 hours? That's a long time to be writing. I was thinking half an hour.
It is. When I'm in the throes of, like, really, like, I wrote my first novel in about 4 months, 3 to 4 months. And I did it by writing about 10 to 12 hours a day. It was the summer between my first and second years as a faculty member. And so I did have the summer off-ish. And so I used that time because I knew I would not have this opportunity again until the next summer. And I found that that intense period of writing, I was also single at the time and I don't have children. So I had a life that made this possible. Mm-hmm. It is intense and I enjoy it because I love writing, but I know it's not everyone's cup of tea.
It just seems kind of like a big, huge chunk of time to be doing, like concentrating on something. That just sounds great to me. So
it's so great. It's so great. Everyone should, if you want it, everyone should be able to do it.
Yeah. We should just do it. Jeff, I've been reminded that it's coming up on 45 minutes.
Yes. I know Roxanne, I know we're up against your time limit. And we really appreciate you being here today. We didn't know necessarily where the conversation was going to go, and we appreciate all the rabbit trails that we were able to go down with you. Thank you very much for joining us. For all the architects that are out there that heard Roxanne or will hear either in the podcast version or you watch the recording of this later, you heard Roxanne talking about architecture from the client's point of view. So that's something that we don't get a whole lot in these conversations. So I hope you all pay attention to what Roxanne was saying, about their process and everything. So thank you very much, Roxanne. We really appreciate you. And again, we hope Debbie gets to feeling better soon. And right before you go, tell me this. What's the next thing that's coming out for you?
Yeah, I have a book coming out on November 16th called How to Be Heard. And it's a book of writing advice. And some of it's incredibly practical because not a lot of writing advice is practical. It's more sort of like Annie Lamott, Bird by Bird, which is a stunning book. I love it. I return to it. But it's spiritual. And this is more like, here's how you actually get it done. And then it's partly about how to use your voice to make the kind of statements you want and to put the kind of work into the world that you want and ideally to create social change. So I'm looking forward to that book.
Excellent. Thank you for that. And for those of you who are watching this, of course, you can find Roxanne's work, her books, wherever books are sold, of course. Lots of bestsellers on the list that'll be very easy to find. You can also check out her column in the New York Times, as well as her podcast that's called Here to Slay. And so I invite all of you to check out Roxanne's podcast as well. So again, Roxanne Gay, thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate you and this conversation, and we hope that we can talk to you again soon.
Awesome. Thank you, architects. And Debbie will be better soon. Just vaccine, it's rough.
Yeah.
I can identify with that.
Send us a picture of your new house. We'd love to see what it turned out looking like.
We will.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks, Roxanne. Thanks for listening to this week's Context and Clarity Live episode. Selfishly, I love these conversations because I get to be the go-between you and some really incredible guests. To that end, I want to know what you think about today's guest. Message me on the socials. I'm really easy to find. I'm Jeff_Eccles everywhere. If you happen to run across a white-haired chiropractor from Austin, Texas, that's not me. I'm the other Jeff Eccles. Oh, and if you have an idea for a future guest, tell me who it is and why you think they'd be a good guest for one of these conversations. Maybe we can get them on a future episode.
All right. If you want more of the Context and Clarity podcast delivered to you, subscribe wherever you consume podcasts. And if you love content like this, check out Gable Media. It's the multimedia network for people that care about the built environment, and it's the home of Context and Clarity. With Gable's growing family of podcasts and video channels, I know you'll find something there that interests you. You can learn more at GableMedia.com. That's GABLMedia.com. So thanks for listening. I hope our time together has inspired you to think about your community and your practice and how you can support those around you. I'll be back here again tomorrow. And in the meantime, I hope you'll join me and the Entree Architect community on Facebook. The link is entrearchitect.com/group. That's where every weekday at 4 p.m., I host Context and Clarity Conversations. And we take these topics, the topics that you hear about in this daily podcast episode, and we dig deeper. We have a conversation in real time so we can help each other find more clarity around the topics that matter most, no matter what your context is.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay. We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.